Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College online journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today on the War Room podcast. I'm Mark Duckenfield, Chair of the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College, and I'm here today in idyllic Carlisle Barracks with Dr. Rob Farley, who teaches at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. Dr. Farley is the author of Grounded, The Case for Abolishing the U.S. Air Force, which was published in 2014 and is still causing turbulence in many circles. I've asked Rob to join me in the studio today to talk briefly about his book, but also to think about the broader implications of domains, forces, capabilities, and military organization in the 21st century. So thank you for joining us today, Rob.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be up here in idyllic Carlisle.
Well, it's certainly our pleasure. I'd like to open with your book. The conclusion's extremely radical and the title rather inflammatory. Would you mind sort of laying out your basic argument, both for why we have an Air Force and why you think it's not such a great idea?
Sure. I tend to think of it not as radical, but as a mild case for a mild bureaucratic reform to the U.S. national security architecture. But it hasn't been taken that way. So, the idea behind Grounded, Abolish the Air Force is that the United States made a mistake in 1947 when it established an independent Air Force, which was mostly removed from the United States Army. So the Army during World War II and prior to World War II had been primarily responsible for the terrestrial use of air power, and the Navy had been responsible for its own maritime branch. But the argument is that the creation of the independent Air Force, which was based around a number of ideas about the decisive effect of air power, along with the need to create an incubator for air power theory and for air power technology, was wrongheaded at the time and has largely passed us by. That as we become more cognizant of the limitations of air power as a decisive use of military force, as we have a better understanding of how military organizations actually function with respect to the air power arms, the case for an independent service as opposed to a branch or some sort of other organizational home for air power has become progressively weaker. And so, while the United States most certainly requires air power in every aspect of its military and defense statecraft, an independent Air Force is not the ideal vehicle with which to deliver that air power.
Well, for the sake of argument, let's assume many of your criticisms on the origins of the Air Force are correct. But let me contrast with perhaps my version of reality with your ideal version of how things should be. Couldn't it still be the case, and perhaps indeed is, that Goldwater Nichols, with its emphasis on jointness, which has really pushed the services, not only the Air Force but the others, away from their parochialism and into deeper cooperation, better reform than abolishing an entire service with what's now about 70 years of tradition, norms, procedures, and so forth?
Well, there's no question that Goldwater Nichols has significantly helped. And it was helping as early as the Gulf War, where we can see some direct effects of Goldwater Nichols. And that was very early on, because a lot of the reforms of Goldwater Nichols are essentially long-range reforms, right? They're supposed to generate different understandings. They're supposed to bring together cultures and so forth. And so I think we've seen a lot of that as an outcome of Goldwater Nichols. And I think we've also seen some reform that's not directly associated with Goldwater Nichols, but that involves questions of how special operations forces have been handled and how the capabilities around special operations forces have been developed. At the same time, I think that we're still seeing the kind of destructive inter-service conflict that Goldwater Nichols was intended to remedy in part, but that remains inevitable when you have even fairly permeable service boundaries. And so I think some of those issues are cultural, and they emerged At times and places during sort of our wars on terror, where misunderstandings between the Air Force and the Army in particular, and misunderstandings of what each service was supposed to deliver, led to problems with war fighting. But more significantly, I think that the services, even in the wake of Goldwater Nichols, remain of critical importance with respect to the development of procurement planning. And so it's this procurement planning where we still see this impact of parochial service preferences that have been really, since the 1960s at least, very hard to break, right? This tripartite arrangement between the Air Force, the Navy, and the Army with respect to the amount they have for procurement funds and the contribution that each of them make to the defense industrial base and the relationships they have with the defense industrial base. I think it's there that you need a bureaucratic surgery, which is more radical than what Goldwater Nichols offered, which was really sort of recognizing there was a major problem between the services and trying to bandage over some of those problems, and successfully in doing so, but as sort of a bureaucratic half step.
Well, in the medical community, they're increasingly trying to move away from surgery and for other less invasive forms of treatment. And this leads me to my next question, that even if we were to do this, wouldn't this be a remarkably destructive bureaucratic reform, tearing apart such a huge, you know, multi-tens, hundreds of billions of dollar organization, then putting it and embedding it into others? Seems like that would be extremely disruptive, with relatively unpredictable consequences for the rest of the national security enterprise until it had worked itself out, which is probably likely given the size of the surgical amputation, if you will, a rather lengthy process.
Right. I definitely think that it is true that were we to undertake the sort of reforms envisioned by the book, it would have been better to start several years ago rather than now. And in fact, I think it would have been ideal to begin even before the beginning of the wars on terror, when we had, you know, in 1947, what we did is we built a national security architecture for managing the Cold War. And that national security architecture, for better or worse, managed the Cold War. But there was sort of a contingent moment at the end of the Cold War when we could have said to ourselves, let us think about an NSC-68, and let us think about a National Security Act, right? Some sort of alternative structure for what our national security architecture should look like moving into the future. And so the closer you get to a period in which you envision especially very intensive, large-scale competition, well, we won't say warfare, but certainly large-scale competition with the peer competitor, which in our case, China, perhaps to a lesser extent Russia, it becomes less ideal to engage in really disruptive major reforms like we're thinking about here. That said, I think we are already seeing areas in which there would be considerable fruit for rethinking our service structure, even in terms of long-range competition with China. You know, the Office of Air-Sea Battle was intended as an area in which the Navy and the Air Force could work out their problems ahead of time, because everybody understood that there would be problems that had to be worked out ahead of time, and this was going to be a place where those problems had to be worked out. And of course, you know, effort moves forward, moves back, and so forth, right? But there's a recognition that there are these service-based issues. I think similarly with the development and sort of the bureaucratic heft that the term multi-domain battle has carried, and this comes largely out of Army circles rather than Air Force and Navy, that you're still seeing, in a lot of ways, background and behind the scenes struggles between the services, right? Multi-domain in battle is both a full recognition of modern technological environment that's associated with warfighting, and is these armies' answer to the problems that are created by the tri-service structure, right? Where there's this concern that the Army will be cut out of the main warfighting capabilities. We wouldn't need air-sea battle, and we perhaps wouldn't need a bureaucratic construct, multi-domain battle. If we had rethought the architecture of our national security state 10 years ago, and I think there's still time to go about and to envision what some radical changes might look like.
Well, one thing that I found quite fascinating about the presentation you gave today at the Army War College was the movement to looking to the future, not at the tri-service structure, but at perhaps embryonic nascent services for cyber or for space, for instance, and what the logic of your argument about the Air Force, a mistake who perhaps is time, it's too late to undo, but that these are lessons we could learn, or at least things that we should consciously think about so we go in with our eyes wide open. Could you speak some to that?
Right. I mean, I think if there's one key lesson to be learned about the independence of the U.S. Air Force, the independence of the Royal Air Force, is that services do not perform fabulously at the job of being good for other services, right? Services will they will develop their own cultures, they will develop their own parochial interests, as any other bureaucratic organization will. And this should give us a lot of caution when we begin to think about a service or creating more of any kind of service. But it should create a lot of caution, particularly in reference to space and to cyber, because both space and cyber encompass huge parts of what the military and national security architecture of the United States is supposed to do. And cyber is something that is part of the intelligence realm, is part of the commercial realm, but it's also critical to the functioning of the three existing services. So in the same sense that when we created an Air Force, we had to carve out space for half a dozen other air forces, right? So that we had a United States Air Force, and the Army had its Air Force, and the Navy has its Air Force, and the Navy's Army has its Air Force, and the Coast Guard has an Air Force. That when we even envision cyber or space, you know, it's impossible for us to imagine taking all cyber capabilities out and putting them into a cyber force, right? So you're inherently thinking about this organization with its own parochial interests that will have to simultaneously serve the needs of another wide swath of the United States government. And that seems to be a higher cost than would really be necessary through some other bureaucratic answers to the question.
Well, but the cyber and space advocates might also point out the advantages of having your own service. If we take space in the fight for resources, an army or a navy or even an air force is going to prioritize its existing missions, its previous strengths, and likely underinvest in an area that you would prefer to have greater investment in. You'd like to be able to develop expertise in, and one that could develop its own profile. So wouldn't that suggest, at least in the realm of space, that a Starfleet or something would be of great utility?
It would, certainly. And I think that part of this conversation has to be sort of a recognition that there is no perfect, optimal, ideal constellation of the national security state, the architecture of the national security state. That instead we are putting forward some values at the expense of other values and optimizing ourselves for some things rather than other things. How I would prefer to approach the problem, rather than taking cyber and space and even the air in which we have aspects of these domains that touch upon everything that the existing services already do, right? So the way that the United States military functions right now is deeply embedded in all three of these: air, space, and cyber, right? Through the way that we talk to each other and the sort of connective communicative sinews that allow the organizations to function. While there probably are some gains to be had from specialization, there are also costs, because when you give a new service the freedom to pursue what it wants to pursue. What it ends up deciding to do with itself and what it ends up deciding to do with that freedom is not necessarily what you envisioned. And so in the case of the Air Force, for example, right? I mean, the Air Force specialized very tightly in a particular kind of warfighting to the lack of expertise and lack of focus on other kinds of warfighting in ways that turned out to be detrimental. And so what I find more appealing is, instead of thinking about domain-specific organizations, to think about services that are organized around broad strategic principles, right? Whether that's management of the commons or decisive warfighting or territorial defense or something along those lines, which give an organization a better grip on bringing into itself and weighing in terms of relative effect and relative impact all of the capabilities that it needs.
All right. Well, one point that you raised in your book was about the sort of strategic options that the Air Force mentality, I'll be something of a caricature here, presents, that it sort of dismisses the Clausewitzian fog of war. In some ways, it's almost like a stereotypical social scientist, that if you can find the right effects, you can bring the enemy quickly to their knees through the independent, decisive use of air power, and that that will be the most efficient way to achieve victory. Is this something that you would see in other domains, that they could, that they, and so your criticism is that this presents policymakers with bad options, and you want to take those options off the table and think more holistically. Would you think the same would be true of cyber and space, or would they, because they tend to be more networked, would they think differently?
That's a really interesting question. With respect to, so I think that whenever we're talking about the creation of a new bureaucratic organization, that fundamentally is all a military service is. That bureaucratic organizations, especially military services, need to have a strong organizing principle in terms of organizational culture. And this organizational culture does not necessarily flow in any predictable way from what the organization is supposed to do. So there are air forces in the world that were not founded along similar principles to the Royal Air Force or to the United States Air Force, and that, you know, do not have the same kind of cultural affection for this idea of independent decisive effect, right? Or this cultural affection for the idea of the sort of fundamental transparency of the battlefield and the fundamental transparency of social, of the social unit. You know, the upshot of that is that there are really unpredictable effects to creating these new institutions, especially these broad-based institutions like cyber and space, which could end up being very problematic as you have sort of internal exclusive cultures that are built around the cyber mission or the space mission, or to phrase that slightly differently, that are built around how the senior leadership and the founding leadership of these institutions view space and view cyber at the time of their creation. Right. If there's anything we know about the way that the Royal Air Force and the United States Air Force came together, it's that the visions of their founders mattered a great deal for how those institutions would perform for a very long time. Right. So that had a deep cultural effect. You know, which is not to say that, you know, if you have a good organizational culture in space and cyber, then everything is going to be fine, because there's still going to be conflicts with respect to the bureaucratic walls and with respect to pursuit of resources. But culture is certainly something to pay close attention to if you do decide to go ahead and to create a space force or a cyber force.
Well, to go even further onto the issue of the sort of strategy that different organizations produce, which is in line with the missions it feels it can accomplish, that will give it greater, you know, autonomy, prestige, resources. Do you find that the current structure of our national security apparatus, with the Joint Chiefs providing military advice and options about largely political problems. Does that then create an inherent bias towards the use of military force, or perhaps their concern about taking casualties might, make them more reluctant to use certain forms of military force?
That's an interesting question, and I think, from my understanding, the empirical answer is that really not necessarily, right? That in terms of when we actually take apart the decision making with respect to Iraq, Iraq 1, Kosovo, Iraq 2, and so forth, that there's not a ton of evidence that the uniformed officer corps in its current configuration is in its advisory capacity to the civilian aspects of the national security state. There's not a ton of evidence to suggest that it tends to be biased towards militant or responses, sort of hard military responses. And so sort of when we worry about militarism and we worry about the selection of sort of excessively kinetic options to certain answers, that kind of selection most often comes from civilians rather than from uniformed military officers. And this is an area in which, and I do talk about this in the book, and I think it's problematic. It helps us to think about why it might be problematic to say have a cyber force, which is to say that civilians are looking for tools to solve problems with. The military is not necessarily pushing military force as a solution to every problem, but when the military is pressed into offering solutions, one of the things that comes out in the toolkit is air power, right? Because we have an entire bureaucracy specifically dedicated to air power, which contains the implication that air power is capable of solving problems, right? And so if we fast forward and think about what that might look like at some point in the future and having an office that is specifically devoted to cyber power, and especially to offensive cyber power, what kind of options that will present to a civilian leadership in the midst of a crisis when they want to go and solve a problem and want to view that problem in isolation from the sort of the broader military and security picture. And so in that sense, once again, I'm wary of creating advocacy groups, bureaucratic lobbying advocacy groups within the government for particular visions of military power, not necessarily for military power as a whole, but for particular understandings of military power.
Well, in a pluralistic democratic society, getting this cacophony of voices up there presenting different options that policymakers can perhaps integrate in various ways would often be seen as an advantage. Just before the fact, excluding certain options as undesirable or counterproductive would seem to limit the choices that policymakers have. Policymakers don't like that, obviously, mm-hmm. but perhaps as citizens, should we not like that as well? Shouldn't we want our policymakers to have as broad a range of options as possible and at the very least hope they have the judgment to be able to choose wisely?
Right. I mean, absolutely from a democratic perspective. But also from a democratic perspective, we elect a president and we elect civilian leaders who very often, and I don't even think this is a new thing, this is an old thing, who lack a great deal of subject matter expertise in the defense realm. But they have a great deal of interest and confidence in solving problems and resolving specific problems. And so this creates a problem of asymmetric information, where a civilian leadership, yes, does want to resolve a particular military issue and wants tools with which to resolve that political specific military issue, but doesn't necessarily understand all of the ins and outs and the problems of escalation and the problems of broader military and strategic impact of a particular military activity. And so what having a cyber force or what having an air force, which mediated, to be sure, by the existence of the Joint Chiefs and the other institutions that bring military advice together, and that mediation is important. But nevertheless, right, having a specific institution dedicated to a particular kind of warfare isn't necessarily a good outcome of the democratic process, in the sense that it gives a civilian leadership that is not particularly interested in or knowledgeable about its ability to use force. It gives that civilian leadership what looks like an easy answer to the problem that they're trying to solve.
So to paraphrase General Jack Ripper's paraphrase of Clemenceau, is war too important to be left to the politicians?
Both of those are, but they are both simultaneously true, right? That war is too important to be left to either the generals or the politicians, right? And even to go beyond that, right? You want military institutions, which are going to be providing advice to civilian leadership when civilian leadership needs to solve problems, you're going to want them to provide advice that is as complex and multifaceted as possible within the cognitive limitations of the people who are providing it and of the president. You think about what your national security architecture wants to look like, and I think that the deeper you can get the integration, right, down to the services being integrated together at a low level, as opposed to the large-scale bureaucratic organizations, which are lobbying groups for particular kinds of warfare, whether they then tightly integrate with the JCS, provides this more multifaceted advice for political leadership that's looking to do something with the world.
Well, thank you very much, Rob. I appreciate you coming to Carlisle and providing us with such a broad-ranging and thoughtful discussion. So thank you very much for your time, and it's been a pleasure having you.
Oh, thank you so much.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.